All right, I know this is a
lot of material to digest, and you're all great courses. Yeah, just
really good conversations down here.
So let's turn a little bit now and think about the early church and how they had to wrestle with this problem. And when I say wrestle, I mean, honestly, literally, in some cases, they had to endure it physically. Because Christians became the spectrum. They were considered noxy, just sort of the lowest dregs of Roman criminality. Like, the Romans began at different points in different places throughout the empire to really despise Christians. And so we are, most of us, familiar with how some Christians were martyred by being fed to lions, right? Or martyred by being crucified in the same way that Jesus was crucified. Or they were martyred in other kinds of ritual executions that were more than just execution, more than just like a beheading. The whole point of the execution was to put the Christian on display.
Right?
And all of these things you may be familiar with, like King Christian's Alliance, those are spectacle entertainments. And so the tradition is, for example, that Paul, that Peter, when he was martyred, asked, you know, that I not be crucified right side up the way my Lord was, but that I be crucified upside down because I'm not worthy to die the way that he died. Right? This is sort of flying in the face of the Roman spectacle entertainment. Because what early Christians often did is they saw these spectacles as an opportunity to share the gospel or to give testimony or witness to the gospel to the general Roman populace. And Ignatius in the second century was a early church leader for whom this was the case. And before he was drug out into the Roman Colosseum, where he was beaten and others were killed, he met with members of his church community. He said, this is my end. This is how it's going to be for me. And this is, and the way that I'm going to think about this is that I want to see myself as a broken body for the people. And he describes, in one of his letters, he describes himself in Eucharistic terms. And if any of you are interested in reading more about this, Robin Darling Young gave a lecture at Marquette University a number of years ago. She called In Procession Before the World. And in that lecture, she describes how early Christians became spectacle, how they used that spectacle to their own devices, and how, in particular, Ignatius imagined himself as following in the footsteps of Jesus, that his body would testify and point towards his Lord. So this is obviously, thankfully, not one of the ways in which we have to grapple with spectacle, right? So thankfully that's the case. But after Christianity was no longer being persecuted, and even after it became legal and the empire became, at least in name, Christian, the emperor's Christian, Christians nevertheless had to continue to deal with spectacle in ways that are a little more relatable to us. And this is certainly the case for Augustine and his contemporaries. As you remember, Augustine was in North Africa. He had a church and people that he was pastoring. He, on the one hand, of course, was a great, magnificent theologian, but he had to deal with questions like, how do we get pagan people who are new to the Christian faith, who have been dramatically formed by the power of these spectacles, to understand what it means to be a Christian? And as it turns out for Augustine and many other church leaders, this is an incredibly difficult problem. one day, it was actually in January, shortly after Christmas, Augustine picked back up with a sermon series he'd been working on. He said, "Now, a few weeks ago, our church was full of people who were here for Advent. But as it turns out today, many of the people who were just here are not here in church. They are instead in a Colosseum-like venue in Carthage." And so he goes on in this sermon to describe how the tension between what it means to be a Christian and the seductions of Rome's entertainment culture and all of its spectacles. And this passage that I read for you before, where he's talking about how Christ is a spectacle, is taken from that sermon, where Augustine is saying to the people who are gathered in the sanctuary, it's not this spectacle, this thing in this Colosseum-like venue, that is going to satisfy and satiate your soul. I know that you're drawn to it. I know that your desires have been cultivated in a way that you want to go and see what happens. You want to be part of the scene. You want to be part of the action. Even if you're, as we said before, repulsed by it. He says, I know that that spectacle is alluring, but what Jesus has is a much better spectacle. So when he calls Jesus a spectacle, he's doing it in the sense that Jesus is doing something very different. But there is this real tension between Jesus as the true spectacle, as Augustine says, or the spectacles of the empire. Now, one of the things that really struck me about Augustine as I read and read and read him, and as he talks about the spectacles, that every time Augustine talks about the spectacles in the City of God, which is his magnum opus, he always talks about the demons. Demons, for Augustine, demons and spectacle kind of go hand in hand. And when I was originally writing and thinking about this, I thought, oh man, I got to figure out how to talk about Augustine and the spectacle without having to talk about the demons. Because that is just a can of worms, right? I mean, you talk about, I mean, it's just such a kind of big issue. And I thought, oh man. But I realized I wasn't going to be able to do that because Augustine, it was so important. These things were so sort of integrally connected. And so, As I dug deeper and deeper, I began to try to understand what Augustine thought a demon was. Let's just stop here for a second and do another word association. When you hear the word demon, what words come to mind? Evil. Monsters. Sorry for...
Speed.
Huh? I'm sorry?
Mascot.
Oh, the school. Wake Forest.
Possession. Maybe possession. Supernatural.
Spirits.
Okay.
What's it look like? Right, like you probably have these, we kind of all have these, this sense of like what demonic possession looks like, or like fear, right? Like this kind of grotesquely evil thing, right? Okay. Now, for most of us, our perception of the demonic comes from some popular images that we consume in various kinds of places. And they also come from some pretty strong, from some powerful biblical stories, right? About Jesus casting out the demons. And so, without sort of dismissing any of that, I want you to just set it aside for a little bit, so that we can think for a little bit about what the demons are for Augustine, okay? And for other early Christians in his time. Because I think this will be somewhat illuminating. I mean, kind of clear your head and say, okay, let's sort of think with Augustine. Now, in Augustine's time, the Romans were worshiping all kinds of images, all kinds of idols, right? And the Romans were very, very good at making these images in various ways. And Christians had this kind of dual view of Romans and their idols. On the one hand, an idol is just a statue, right?
And Christians kind of make fun, and Augustine makes fun of Romans, like, you worship this statue that you made, this graven image, right? It's just a statue. Why do you think that's a god? Right? And so there's on the one hand a kind of a dismissive sensibility for Christians. Like, oh gosh, you know, how would you regard that thing? On the other hand, for Augustine, there's a deep concern. Because there's something behind that image. Because as Augustine watches pagan religion enacted in the Roman world, he recognizes that it's effective. On the one hand, these might be graven images, but if they're really not, how come they have so much social impact? How come they're so powerful in the culture? And so Augustine, like most early Christians, regarded the worship of Roman gods as demon worship. So the image itself was an image, but behind the image, behind these things, there was a diabolical, demonic force at work. The Apostle Paul says something very similar to this in Corinthians when he's talking about food that's been sacrificed to idols. Do you remember this passage, 1 Corinthians 8? In that passage, what is happening is that some people in the community were really bothered by the eating of food that had been sacrificed to idols. And other people said, it's nothing because idols aren't anything. So, you know, what does it matter whether it's been sacrificed to an idol or not? Because idols aren't anything. And Paul has to work with this tension, right? On the one hand, it seems to be nothing. And on the other hand, it is kind of significant. And the same is true for the way they thought about these graven images. And so, when you think about images in modern culture, it's kind of interesting how easy it is for us to produce them, isn't it? It's gotten to the point now where images are actually easier produced than words, which is kind of remarkable, right? Like, you can just scroll down your Facebook feed, like one image after another. Easier to whip out your phone and take an image and post it than it is to write a text or a post or something.
And so images to us feel like they're kind of insignificant because we're so surrounded by them, right? But when was the last time you saw an image that really grabbed you? That you just sort of like, oh, that was a really powerful image. Can you think of a time? Can you think of an image? Let's give you a second. So we have this kind of interesting relationship with images, don't we? Where, on the one hand, we're surrounded by them and we don't really think anything of it, but then all of a sudden, like, whoa, that photo is amazing. There are photo blogs, of course, and the whole point is to like post really dramatic images that capture our attention. And Augustine has this same sensibility. It's like, you know, on the one hand, these images that these Romans produced, these graven images, they're nothing. And on the other hand, they have this real power. And so he says to them, you worship these images, you're worshiping these demonic beings. Now here's where it gets a little interesting, because here's what Augustine thinks a demon is then. So let me step back. The image is the medium through which you worship the demon, and this is what the demon is for him. A demon is a fallen angel. That means it's a hybrid being. On the one hand, the demon has divine properties. Okay, it's like God. And it's like God in the sense that demons are immortal, right? They don't die. They don't get sick. They're spiritual beings. But on the other hand, and this is what's interesting, Augustine says demons have bodies. So, Their bodies are kind of spiritualized bodies, but like us, they suffer from what Augustine calls the passions of the soul. The passions of the soul are like lust, greed, and violent desires, and all the things that we sort of associate with powerful sin, right? So Augustine is, he says these demons are a kind of hybrid demigod. And demigod was often a word that got used for the demon. So if we were to sort of show this, on the one hand you have, if you could imagine, God at the top, and humanity or imminent mortality at the bottom, the demon would be a kind of hybrid between these two things. And so they're a hybrid because they have a body, so they're like us. They suffer from the passions of the soul, so they're like us. But their bodies don't die. And when they engage in the passions of the soul, there aren't any consequences. If you and I decide that we're going to go on a bender this weekend, and we just drink and drink and drink ourselves into oblivion, what happens? We end up with a hangover, right? Ask most any frat, right? Like, there's a kind of limit to our embodiments. But that wouldn't be the case for a demon. A demon can just go on and on and on and on in the passions of the soul. And their bodies are perfect, because they don't get sick and they don't get old. So now, let me ask you again. What's a demon look like for Augustine? If it's this thing. Passions of the soul. It's lustful. It's got this insatiable desire. It's got a body, but its body isn't like our bodies. Its body's perfect. It doesn't get old. Its body is perfectly strong. And the way that the Romans worship these demons is by creating images. Creating powerful images. So if you're going to worship this demon, what kind of image would you create? What does it look like? Wouldn't it look an awful lot like an Abercrombie and Fitch ad? Right? I mean, if you were going to create a picture of that thing, or many, many similar kinds of ads that are everywhere in youth culture, right? I mean, for those of you who can't see this particular image, it's a half-naked woman laying on top of a half-naked man. But, sorry about that. But it's interesting, right? Like, what happens in marketing to our bodies? I think that if Augustine was here, if Augustine was walking through Times Square, he would say, "Whoa, demons everywhere." And what he was saying to the Romans is, you Romans, you keep wanting to worship these demons. You idolize these demons, literally and figuratively. You turn them into an ideal. You wish that you could be like the demons. That you too could have this perfect body. That you too could engage in the passions of the soul without any kind of consequence. That you too could live forever and never suffer the effects of aging. You want to be like the demons. I get it. They're beautiful. It's really appealing. And the demons love the spectacle. The demons are the spectacle. I get why you'd be so drawn to that. But here's what he says to them in City of God in books 8 and 9. He says, these demons, they're just hybrid beings. They're partly God and they're partly human. They're partly human. They're immortal on the one hand, but they have the passions of soul on the other. Do you really want to be like the demons? Is that what you want? A part human, part God being? Is that what you're trying to be like? Because what I really think you want, when you want this demon-like life, and you're drawn to that, I think what you really are after is not the part the human, part the divine, but the fully human and the fully divine. And Augustine contrasts the demon with the incarnate Christ. That is, and what he's saying is that that Rome's love of the demonic, what I portrayed here is that Abercrombie and Fitch had, is a misguided desire for Christ. And this gets us back to where we were before we wrote. That perhaps these images that are saturated, that have saturated youth culture, right, to sort of hold up what Augustine would describe a kind of demonic ideal, it's a really appealing life, it's a really appealing way of being, that's a kind of distorted desire for God. And if we could begin to name that the way Augustine did with the Romans, then we can begin to help young people understand what's forming them, the way they're being formed by the culture and by the spectacle, and say, look, we get it. We get that it's powerful. We get what the appeal is. But there's something better. This is like cotton candy that the culture's giving. What I'm trying to give you is this wonderful steak dinner. Sorry to vegetarians. Right? That there's this, you think this is what you want, but what we have is actually something much better. So let me stop there and see if any of this is resonating with you.
I think one of the challenges that I would have as a pastor, if I start talking about demons, to be nice, we might talk about addiction. To be truthfully blunt, we're talking about a trip to the state mental hospital. But helping, I mean, I'm seeing what you're saying, and it's fascinating. But when I use that word, that's the thing that pops up in my mind. I've got somebody with severe mental illness, not that they like looking at perfect models, and would like to be one day, and that, you know, can't understand why they can't do that. So help me some of that. Thank you.
So early Christians, recognizing this kind of demonic power of the spectacle, would practice, in order for someone to become a Christian in Augustine's church, had to go through a very intensive process that involved exorcism. Ritual, all kinds of ritual exorcisms happened over and over again. Augustine did this in his church. Chrysostom did it in his church. It was just part of life. Please don't go home to your church and say, this guy from Princeton says we need to practice exorcism on all conferences. Right? This language of the demonic isn't our language. It doesn't work for us in the same way that it worked for them. And part of the reason is because it's just not in our vernacular. Right? I mean, some Romans regularly talked about worshiping demons. It was like saying, I'm worshiping this demigod. There are actually, in the massive amphitheater in, or a Colosseum-like building in northern Africa, just outside of Tarsus, they found little tablets that were prayers written to literally demons, right? Like, dear demon, help my gladiator to win. So this wasn't, it didn't have the same kind of connotations for them that it did for us. And your point has to be really helpful in that we can't just take this language and directly into our mind. We're going to have to figure out some other ways to talk about it, right? But what I do want to help us do is recognize that what Augustine is dealing with in his church so many centuries ago is not altogether different than what we're dealing with when we talk about his culture. And so I think you're absolutely right. We have to really think through these dynamics, and we might have to find some different language. The word, I mean, you, what I did was I tried to help you all, or try to get you all set a word, set aside the meaning of the word demonic, which you have, in order to do this, right? So I think you're right. But that would be a bigger conversation, and I'd love to have it. But my hope is that we can begin to see that the centuries of time actually have a separate perception.
Question over here.
I think it's really interesting when you put like the words like the spectacle and the demons on the culture, and I like to point out that it's now with cell phones, like I have one in my pocket, it's so easy to just pow, it's right there, the spectacle. Mm-hmm. And it's really easy to just, you can, and now with the internet, you can be into it, you can be a part of the spectacle. And like, but you can't ever fully be a part of the spectacle, but, and it's just, it kind of, you can feed off it, but it's never quite enough.
Right.
And I think one thing in our church is, for a while, we have youth nights every other Friday, and for a while we used to have what we called the Chateau iPod, and that was where we left our phones, and we weren't allowed to use them during that time. But over time, it just, what we were experiencing in youth night was like so much better, so much more filling than what was on our phones, that we don't even have that anymore. We just leave it in our pockets. It's not a thing that we immediately reach for. And I think it's because we have experienced the like the fullness of Christ. Mm. And when you put words on it like that, it's a lot, I don't know, it's a lot clearer for me as a youth. I think it's a lot clearer. Although, I agree with him though, if I went to school and was like,
yeah.
Hey, you know that in your phone?
Right. Yeah.
So,
lose a lot of friends real quick that way.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this: How hard did your pastor or youth pastor or whoever the adult leader? How hard did they have to work with you and your youth group to get you all to give up your cell phones that way?
Surprisingly, not that hard. I don't know about for me. I know it wasn't hard, but I know for other kids it was. But it's just there's more of a sense that you don't need it, and you're being present with the people there, and. And when you're with the people there, you don't need the people in your pocket. You don't need the spectacle.
But it's something that you had to learn. Right?
Yeah,
you had to learn, and you had to be convinced of it. And in a sense, I mean, maybe this language will seem too foreign to you, but you had to learn how to want differently, didn't you?
Yeah.
Right? You had to learn a new desire. Because the culture, the kind of the power of the spectacle had cultivated your desire in one way, and it had to get shifted into a different way, right? I'm glad to hear it didn't take as much effort as I would have imagined. Yeah, please.
I'm actually one of Brendan's youth leaders. So.
Oh.
Brendan wasn't there to take the phone away, but I was. I remember a kid, a high school sophomore, who came in and we asked. Brendan talked about the iPod Chateau or iPhone Chateau that we put in the box. And he actually had a reaction to that, physiological reaction.
Mm-hmm.
And it was fascinating to me. I think different kids have different spectrum of reacting to us taking their phone.
Yep.
It actually became a part of him. So,
yep.
But he did come back. It was the first time it was very difficult, but then it became easier and easier each time.
So I think the language that you're using actually, Brendan, is that your name?
Yeah.
Brendan was helping us see that the language points to practices, right? That we don't need to use the word demon to help a student be separated from the spectacle that they carry in their pocket, right? I was also thinking before this picture came up about the value that we place on just youth, not people, but the quality of being young and being sort of immortally young, and that this language also, I was thinking, what helps us get away from that demon, the thing that we want to be perpetually young? And I think we're going to talk about that a little bit in terms of getting practices of students mixing with people who are not chronologically young, right?
Yeah.
Like if we want students not to idealize Abercrombie and Fitch bodies, what we have to do is put people with gray hair around them, right? And so the language, even though the language might be problematic, it helps us get to a set of practices that I think combat
right.
the demonic.
Right.
So I'm thinking, do you think that maybe the, you know, we have the, you say that this desire to be like that is like a misguided desire to be like Christ, to be perfect like Christ. Do you think that maybe the reason a lot of you young people give up on Christianity is because it's so much easier to idealize and try to be like that than it is to try to be like Christ? And in the lazy society that we have, with the younger generation, maybe that's, you know what I mean? It's just so much easier to try to be like that than it is to try to be like Christ. They just kind of give up on it. You know, maybe that's, I don't know, I just kind of had that thought.
Well, I think then the question would be, why is it easier, right? And in a sense that, and there may be two ways to think about it, and that is, you know, if you're in a river and the current's going this way, it's always easier to just kind of go with the current than it is to kind of swim counterculture against the river. But the other is, I think that there's the analogy I'd want to go back to is it's the difference between giving a kid cotton candy, right, which tastes good at the moment, but robs their body of nourishment, right, and giving them a meal that's organic and full of good vegetables and good nutrients that will also taste good if they give it a try, but it's going to be an acquired taste. They're going to have to learn to like it if what they've been eating the whole time is cotton candy. And this is what this is how our bodies function, and I think it's also how our souls function. If our souls have been feasting on the spectacle, that's what's being pumped into us all the time. Then when we try to turn to the other thing, it's going to take a while. And this is why early Christians like Augustine had a catechetical process that was not just about giving people information about the faith. It was about trying to reform habits and desires, and why it took months and months to do that. And they had to go through all of these disciplines, which included fasting and prayer and all of these things, to try to begin to have a different palate, to want something new. And it didn't always work. One of the remarkable things that Claude Lodeus and Tertullian complained about is that Christians who would go through the catechetical process and get baptized, become fully embraced by the church, and they would get to that pinnacle moment in every catechumen's experience when they're baptized and they're brought in for the first time to receive the Eucharist. And they've been told this whole time about this wonderful sacrament that they're going to experience when this whole process is done. And they get there, and it's just bread and wine. And they're like, where's the spectacle? Where's the spectacle? We want, like, are you serious? This is it? Right? Like, it's just bread and wine? That's all you've got for me? Because right? They're still sort of hungry for the pagan spectacle.
Okay. Yeah, that's the one. What's that?
We don't want to look at it anymore.
Oh, you don't want to look at it anymore. Sorry.
Sorry about that. Right, sorry, go ahead.
I think there's something wonderfully hopeful about this way of framing it. I mean, deeply Augustinian, right? But that so often, like, people in this room, I think, and myself included, tend to think of Christianity as an incredibly difficult thing, to think that when you're talking about having to radically pull the will from going this way, friendship in this other direction, and something about being able to name what it is that is the path of least resistance for me, as much as every well of the youth that we talk about, is you know, the Facebook and the internet. I don't like TV particularly, but I'm sucked into those same things. So I think we can think about how hopeful it is to start to say, this thing that is for you the path of resistance, this thing that is where your heart goes, what you long for, you don't necessarily have to be pulled away from it, but almost but through it, right?
Yeah.
That there's a clinging to what really is good there, and then pushing through and past that into what's substantive.
Yeah.
That's one way of framing it that I think, I find it very
idea that for Augustine, a demon is this kind of higher being, right? This thing that is immortal, but it's got a body, but it's got these distorted desires. It's insatiable, right? It's lustful, even bloodlust. But its body's perfect, and it's strong, and it's powerful. It's eternally young, never gets old. Think again, what does that look like? Wouldn't it...
How many are familiar with the Twilight series? Isn't it a vampire? It's a vampire. Right? That is the central figure of the Twilight series, is this being that is what Augustine describes as a demon. And it's not too far yet from the demon to the vampire. And what happened to the Twilight series, the same thing that happened to adolescent novel series that became blockbuster movies, which were really, really bad movies. And what happened is you had millions and millions of young women and some not so young women who just loved this vampire. And how does the Twilight series end? What's the culmination of the story? Is when the young woman who loves the vampire herself becomes a vampire. Herself becomes the demon. And now her life is full. Friends, this is the cotton candy. Of course that the young woman is going to see this and feel like, man, that would be such an amazing life, wouldn't it? I mean, that story resonated deeply with millions of young women. And what we're saying is we get that it resonates. But it's just cotton candy. We've got something better for you. Somebody have another question? Oh, sorry.
Just going to ramble about something for a minute that I thought was really helpful in your talk, and that was when you described Augustine's view of the demons as experiencing all the passions of the soul with no consequences. And I think of Augustine as a cultural critic, and I'm wondering if instead of always having to put your iPhone down, whether it's important, as you're saying, to work through it and teach people to be cultural critics and to analyze these images and show how there is no sense of sin, and that's really maybe what's drawing people to these kind of images. It's not a healthy sense of sin, which is a little bit pride, right? So analyzing some of those passions and vices and becoming cultural critics and not saying, I can keep up this forever and ever.
As a parent of a two-year-old myself right now, I'm resonating with a cotton candy steak kind of analogy. But what I'm thinking about is I'm also very aware right now that there's, in parenting culture, in parenting literature, there's sort of two general streams. One is the respect your child's desires and wishes and just, like, you let them lead themselves and go in a certain direction. And then there's another side that talks more about forming your child's desires. And that's a lot of what you're talking about, is forming desires. And this kind of maps onto church life as well. How do we... Some would see it as a kind of an arrogant move to think that we know how to form someone else's desires. And to do that to your child is one thing. But to do that in a church context is taking it to another level, too. How do we... how do you go there?
Yeah. Right, because in consumer culture, all of our desires are supposed to be our own, mm-hmm. and acting on our desires is supposed to be an act of free will and an act of freedom, right? Unless so, the only people who are allowed to shape desire in our culture are the marketers, and the way that they often shape our desire is by trying to tell us. The desire they want us to have is our idea. Have it your way at Burger King. Right? I saw American Eagle ad the other day.
be yourself, right? Like, that was the American Eagle ad. Like, do you all understand the tension here? Like, this is American Eagle telling you to be yourself. Like, how does that work?
So you're right that I got to tell you, reading the way that the early church was the degree to which they were willing to go to exercise literally the bad desires and help somebody cultivate new desires is pretty alarming. And so, to us, right, to our sensibilities, and I don't think that we just simply reappropriate their practices exactly. But what I do think they help us to do is recognize, like, hey, maybe we believed a lie, or at least too much of a lie, from our culture, and that
thinking that our desires are wrong. Part of what we need to be doing as friends in the body of Christ is helping each other recognize how this desire or that desire is gone, is skewed. What is it for you? What thing do you just wish you could have? Mine is boats. I love boats. All kinds of boats. I love boating. And I can look at boating magazines and boating stuff all day long. And pretty soon that starts to get in me, right? And then pretty soon I start thinking, man, I would sure love to have this thing. And for you, it's probably not boats. But it's something else, right? I sure wish I could have those new granite countertops. I sure wish I could have that new Mac computer. Naming that, saying like, hey, spectacle got in you, man. Started messing with you. Started giving you something that shouldn't really be there. What should be there? A love for the poor. How does that get in there instead? Right? How do we cultivate that instead?
It's not a new problem. It's helpful. Yep, Brent.
Jim, sorry. I'm curious whether you might allow that one of the differences between, we spent the day on similarities between Rome and 21st century North America, but perhaps one of the differences is that spirituality or the world of the spiritual, the world of angels and demons, is kind of, it's at least diminished, if not gone underground. So in Rome, everybody believed in something. Mm-hmm. In the present day, there are people who would say that any pretense of some other realm is just silliness.
Right.
And so what was literally the case in Rome is now you have to almost make a metaphor in order to make your points. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if that's a different kind of, then in fact we're not facing exactly the same kind of situation that Augustine faced.
That is a really helpful and important question. Here's how at least I think about it. You use the word belief, right? Like they believed in these beings, right? In a way that we don't, at least most of the culture does not believe in them in the same way. And, well, that is true sort of conceptually, right? Like you could sit somebody down and say, do you believe in demons, right? And they would say, no, I also don't believe in UFOs, right? And this is one of the things we get, forgive me, but this is one of the things we get from the Enlightenment, is this kind of conceptualizing where we
Like, yes, I believe in this, or I don't believe in that, and that's the end of the day. So you sit somebody down, you sit young people down, and you'll say, no, I don't believe in demons. And then they'll say in the next sentence, but I really want to go see that Twilight movie. And so I want to say that, so then how is belief working? Right? It may very well be cognitively, conceptually, you don't operate in the same way that somebody 2,000 years ago would have when it comes to the demons. But nevertheless, there is this real desire and longing to connect with that ideal. Right? There's still an operation of desire. And I think identifying that helps us not just bridge the gap between the ancient and the modern, but it helps us recognize like what's going on, and that a lot of the conceptual work we do around belief isn't anywhere near enough, because it doesn't get into the heart, and it doesn't get deep into the soul to really enact change. And that's why I think our problem, quite frankly, culturally, isn't secularism. It's paganism. It's not that we don't believe in transcendent beings. It's that we believe in tons of them, or we're at least attracted to them. Why does everybody... What's the deal with all the superhero movies? I cannot figure this out. Other than that, it's another kind of embodiment of this demonic ideal. We wish we had these super strong bodies, and we wish that we would live forever, and we just keep churning them out one after another after another after another. It was like 16 Spider-Man movies or something. I don't know. Right? And what's interesting there, too, is how sort of technology plays a role. Right? Trying to get ourselves... We wish we could be like this. So, I think you're right, Fred, but I think the problem is paganism. We just don't have the... It's just hard to name it as that because we're so convinced that we're more enlightened than that.
Question about...
Okay, thanks. Illuminating biblical manuscripts, right? So they're like icon kinds of images. And what we do, what I try to do every evening, I don't always succeed certainly, but before he goes to bed, we sit down, and he reads aloud a passage from the St. John's Bible, and he works through the hand calligraphy. And when we get to an image on a particular page, we dissect the image together. And this is really rich, and what you said about children having these reflective capacities. I see that in my kid. We certainly see it in teenagers. My gosh. I mean, that it's there. But it gets sidelined and distorted by, like you said, the mundane and the spectralness. It's very mundane. It doesn't do this reflective cultivation. So, I mean, one practice I'd suggest for us all is like, let's just sit down and read the St. John's Bible. But I certainly see it in my mind. Jenny, what time do we have? We're happy. Okay, so I want to do one more question, and then I want to give you some work to do in tables. What's that? Okay, great.
The line that stuck out to me a lot was when you said people get to the Eucharist and they say, "Where's the spectacle?" And I think they're going to encounter that a lot in church and the practice of our the working out our faith and stuff. And so, back to what you said about Rome, people were trading their political power for the grand circuses and for the spectacle. And as a way of like sacrificing that relationship or whatever. So I think that I think the task is to try and find out how the simplicity of that God doesn't need the spectacle to restore our relationship with us. So the task is, how do we engage the propaganda to deconstruct the spectacle in that sort of language we can? You know, bring down the spectacle that they're all worshiping. So how do we engage the culture in a way that shows that you're not going to see the spectacle because Jesus doesn't need it?
Yeah, and That's what all the church fathers said to their people. This is weird. Tertullian is going on and on about this. He wrote a book called On Spectacle, by the way. Tertullian wrote a whole treatise on this called On Spectacle. And one of the things they say is, we're just, you can beg us for it all day long, but we're not going to give you anything more than this bread, this wine, this sacrament. That's what you do to me. Even if you don't think that's what you need, we're telling you. A long time. Okay. Okay. Great. Sorry.
Okay. I'll be quick. Thanks.
Well, I mean, if this is what y'all want to do, I'm perfectly fine with it. But keep going.
So I feel like we're coming back to desire again and again and again. Like, how can we work with the formation of desires or desires that have been like appropriated by demonic cultural forces? Yep. Like, what do we do with this? And it makes me think of two things. The first is a book called A Field Guide to Getting Lost by Rebecca Solnit. And in the first chapter of that book, she talks about how we have turned desire into this straight up, void filling of the void relationship. It's a lack, and then you fill the lack, and that is the entire picture of desire. And what she paints instead is this imagery using like the language of the horizon. She talks about the blue of the horizon as this desire. You cannot have it. You cannot appropriate the horizon to yourself. But if you're like bold enough to desire something that far away, it will always be with you. But it's like living in that kind of tension, having a desire and not trying to fulfill it. What is that? And then the other thing I used to think of is one of the more formative philosophy classes that I had in college. One time, my favorite teacher was talking about love. We were actually talking about Augustine, and he shared, and we're talking about desire too. He shares that love is the opposite of need. If you need water and then you get it, you don't have to want water anymore. If I'm thirsty and then someone gives me a cup of water, it's no longer on my mind, it's no longer in the equation. It's like, it has been fulfilled. But if you love someone and you draw close to them, the flame grows. It increases. It overflows. It pours out. And so these desires for, you know, the superhuman perfect body thing, it's like, well, in a sense, that's something we can never have, but it's been commodified into this thing that I can consume. I can go to the Spider-Man movie. Like, I can feel that rush of participating in it. But what are these greater desires that, like, I don't know. I just think about that in terms of formation, allowing young people to sit in distress, in tension, in unfulfillment, and not immediately trying to, like, placate or fix or fill.
All right. Well, I mean, this is a really, I'm glad you said that. It's a better segue than the one I was going to offer. So here's what I think we want to spend a few minutes doing. I want you to, in your table groups, talk together about two questions. And they're almost the same question. There's one important difference. But these are the two questions, and I'll pass around the sheets so that you have them and you can write on them. We'll come back later to see what you come up with. But here's the question. The first one is, what activities, experiences, relationships, and practices are essential for the discipleship of a young person into mature Christian adulthood? What activities, experiences, relationships, and practices are essential for helping a young person become mature? And then the second question is the same. What activities, experiences, relationships, and practices are not necessarily necessary, but you think that's really helpful, right? If you think are really key. You wouldn't say they're absolutely essential, but they're still really helpful and you should think about. So I want you to think about these two questions in your table groups for about 10, 12 minutes, something like that. And we're going to see what we come up with. And wrestle with these questions a little bit in light of this idea of the many things we've been talking about, right? This, how do we form desire? How is desire already formed in us all? All right, well, let me call you back because as you would probably smell a pizza. As have I. So we've been talking about these questions, and we've only got a couple minutes left. And so we don't have time to sort of go around and sort of collect the different things that some of you have come up with at your groups. If you did happen to write them down, if you want, just leave those sheets on the table and I'll collect them and can make a list of some of the different kinds of things that you've come up with. It might be helpful to have a kind of list that can go back and say, oh, that's a good idea. I wouldn't have thought of that. Somebody came up with that. That's a good idea. Here's the thought that I want to leave you with. Here's the typical youth group model, okay? Youth ministry model. Typical youth ministry model is youth group model that involves these five things. At least these five things. You could say more, but go something like this. We separate youth into their own group, and then we hire a youth minister to run programs of various kinds for the young people. And then we designate considerable funds to the youth minister's salary and benefits and provide a special budget for youth ministry programming. Or at least we try to do that as best we can. Turns out many churches find that's a very difficult thing. And then we purchase products from the youth ministry industry, which, quite frankly, is kind of heavily invested in spectacle these days, to aid in the facilitation of programming and instruction of youth. And then finally, we create a youth committee that oversees the work of the youth minister and the youth ministry budget. Now, you can tell from my tone that I'm not a super huge fan of this model. Here's my question for you. You have been talking about practices, relationships, experiences that you think are essential or at least very valuable for the formation of young people in your church, in your sphere of influence. And what I'd like just to close with is to ask you this. Is this model necessary to do the things that you think are important, that you wrote down on the sheets or talked about in your group? And my guess is, it's not. And I've asked these questions to many, many, many youth ministers. And almost the overwhelming majority of the time is the things that we come up with when we ask ourselves these questions, we don't need this model to do. And so why are we doing this model? Why are we doing this model? I think that there are way better ways for us to engage young people. And we've been thinking deeply about the impact of culture on young people, about the way that we engage the culture, trying to provide some frameworks for that. Y'all can take that in so many different ways. You don't need permission from me or anybody else to dream up new models for raising young people in our faith. But if you do need permission, please hear. We don't have to do this. We don't have to do this. And if this is what your church is doing and it's working for you, go back and ask yourself if it's really working for you. And if it's working for you, great. But what you're going to hear in some of the other sessions, I know, especially when we watch the movie Soul Searching, is that it's not working for the overwhelming majority of churches. And we all are capable of doing some really reflective thinking about what it is that's actually forming our kids, how we provide a counterformation for that, and how we begin to help kids really reflect deeply and become vital disciples of Jesus Christ. So I want to leave you with that. You have everything you need to do it, and please, let's reimagine some of this together. Sound good? Thank you.